Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O.reefermed.ca.
And then you have to have somebody such as themselves or an caregiver to give it to them, which is ludicrous because the nurses in the facilities, at least in the state of California, cannot gift them the cannabis that they need.
There are so many answers that lie dormant within those plants that we have yet to tap.
Hi, this is Biff Naked, and you're listening to the Reefer Madness podcast.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk. We are back.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I am well. So on the line today, I've got Ryan Cocott. I stumbled across him on LinkedIn. I seem to be doing that a lot lately. So this is loosely a follow-up to Kylie Beaudry from a few episodes ago. So when I was talking to Kylie, and she was our evolution of an entrepreneur, she was talking about in the U.S. there was these things called MSOs, and I had no idea what that was. So it's a multi-state operator. And so if you own a cannabis company in one state and you want to do the same thing in another state, it is difficult. And if you manage to do that, you are now an MSO, a multi-state operator. And Ryan happens to be a cannabis lawyer who might help you with things like that. So that's sort of how this all started.
Any
thoughts about him before we jump in?
Well, he refers to himself as a compliance lawyer, and he explains it in the interview. But I guess from my perspective, how I relate to this kind of stuff is that I was thinking about my scope of practice. And again, as a pharmacist, your scope of practice, if we're ever called upon our practice, if something's wrong or our colleges call us, it would be on our competencies, right? Or our compliance to the competencies. So what would be in front of us and who we would bring to defend us is a compliance lawyer, somebody that understands our scope of practice, understands what we do as a nurse, what you do as a pharmacist. And then were we compliant to the competencies and our skill set? So he applies those skills of compliance to cannabis companies. So I just so people sort of relate that into your practice. I mean, everybody, any professional group has a body that watches out for your compliance. So this is the lawyer who's watching out for the compliance.
Yeah. And he, this is not meant to slight at Ryan or any of our other legal colleagues. Honestly, law stuff usually bores me to tears because they just seem to be pointless rules argued over here that has very little to do with what I'm trying to do over here. But I thought this one was really interesting, you know, and kind of the hoops you have to go through if you south of the border. Now, I'm not saying there aren't hoops up here, but this was specifically in the U.S. If you want to sort of run a cannabis business. And hey, this was way more entertaining than I thought it. Usually you are the guy who's fascinated by the laws. I really like this one.
I enjoyed this conversation as well. And, you know, pharmacy and it might be different than nursing, but in the last 14 years, my practice has been at a very high level. So I'm often thinking about, you know, when I get into a situation that requires me to work within guidelines, and guidelines are just that, they're guidelines, right? They're not necessarily rules or the law, they're guidelines. So as you walk through the guidelines, sometimes you're thinking to yourself, what would a compliance lawyer say about this? You know, so I get it. In my practice, I often medical legal issues, and I'm it's unfortunate that I have to say this, but often my practice is dictated by, gee whiz, if I'm successful, I get an ice cream. You know, if I'm not successful, oh boy. You know,
we run into that a lot, but let's go away from pharmacy and nursing.
Let's talk to the compliance lawyer, shall we?
And we'll go back to Ryan and tour through cannabis law south of the border. Here's Ryan.
On the line today, we have Ryan Colcott. Ryan, tell everybody a little bit about you and how you got into the cannabis industry.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Massachusetts, moved out to California in 2011. I had had the choice as far as law school goes between Sacramento, California or Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was thinking about going to Marquette, and it turned out that Milwaukee, Wisconsin is the second coldest city in the United States next to Minneapolis, Minnesota. So we went with California. If you have an audience made up of any number of Canadians, I'm guessing I'm preaching to the choir about that. But,
You know, it's nice to have seasons. Seasons are good.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, too. Growing up in Massachusetts, it you definitely experience some cold. And I think I had stepped foot in California once on a layover to Las Vegas, on a layover in San Francisco. So I kind of just came out here on a whim. And that's where I am now. I live in Sacramento, California. I practice law here in California, but as well as my home state of Massachusetts and New York. I was in-house for a company and the director of compliance for a multinational company, cannabis company that is, that started off as a startup and eventually went public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. And during that time, I was a Swiss Army knife, so to speak, and was exposed to any number of legal and compliance issues within the cannabis space. And I use that experience now as private counsel. You know, if you look on my website, it'll say cannabis business attorney, because just candidly, that's kind of what skews well on Google in terms of search. I'm really more what, you know, an attorney, another attorney would call a deal attorney. I help a lot of existing operators work joint ventures, trademark and other intellectual property licensing agreements. Operators that are looking to scale into other states is what my day-to-day looks like. So I run a lot of contracts in the cannabis space. And by virtue of doing contract work, you're really doing compliance work at the same time. So I kind of use my old skills that I developed in-house as director of compliance in that vein too. But I... what I would call a deal attorney in the cannabis space.
Okay. Now, just because I'm sure there's going to be people who don't know, what do you mean by compliance work? What's compliance work?
So I get on my soapbox about this on LinkedIn, on social media in general, is that the cannabis industry has a bad habit of only considering state and local cannabis specific operational regulations when we talk about compliance. But compliance really extends far beyond that into insurance, into corporate compliance. So in other words, making sure your corporate documents are in order, that you're filing what you need to file annually or every 2 years, depending on the type of entity. Contract compliance. So what I mean by that is cannabis companies have a really bad habit of signing a contract and just throwing it in the top drawer and never looking at it again, and not having systems in place to make sure you're actually abiding by the terms of that contract. So when I say compliance, it could really mean any number of different things depending on the context that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you. Not being a lawyer, I didn't know either. And we're going to talk about some other things, but when we were initially chatting, things that sort of came to my attention was multi-state operations. Now, our audience will hopefully remember when we were talking with Kylie Beaudry, she was dipping her toe into, she's been mostly in Canada, but we're dipping her toe into talking to people in the U.S., and she came up with this MSO thing that we had no idea. So in Canada, cannabis is federally regulated. Now, not to say different provinces don't have their own little quirks, but, you know, it's federally legal. In the U.S., it's completely different. It is not federally legal. And so if I wanted to have my business cross state lines, what's involved?
So it depends on what type of business we're talking about. So cannabis has two different varietals that are regulated within the United States. We have hemp as one varietal of cannabis, and then marijuana as one varietal of cannabis. The distinction between the two is a legal one. The distinction is, does the plant have more than 0.3% delta-9 THC? If it does have more than 0.3% delta-9 THC, it's classified as marijuana. If it has less than 0.3% THC, it's classified as hemp. Marijuana is still listed as a Schedule I substance under the Controlled Substances Act, which, long story short, means it's quote-unquote illegal at the federal level. Despite that, in the United States, states at the state level have legalized and commercialized cannabis. So what it looks like to expand into other states really depends on whether or not we're talking about hemp products or marijuana products.
Let's assume marijuana products. I've got a high THC gummy that is selling really well in Colorado, and I want to now do something in Massachusetts.
Well, I think the real key thing to understand about that if we're talking about marijuana products, is I can't cross state lines with marijuana products, legally at least, right? So if I'm in Colorado and I want to make gummies in Massachusetts, you have to think about each state as its own silo, call it. So if I want to start operating in Massachusetts, I have to figure out a way to get my gummy recipes from Colorado to Massachusetts, which usually involves just working with an operator, an existing licensee in Massachusetts, to produce that gummy, or B, to just get licensed myself. People usually go with the former option in terms of finding an existing operator, though, because ultimately, when you're talking about getting licensed from scratch, you're talking about up to 2 years potentially of a licensing process and hundreds of thousands of dollars in getting there as far as getting your own license.
Okay.
That being said, though, it also really comes down to the size of the company that we're talking about. If gummy manufacturer in Colorado is a multinational public company on the CSC, with substantial funding, there's a possibility that they're just going to try to acquire an operator in Massachusetts, or maybe even go through the licensing process because they have the money to do so. If gummy manufacturer in Colorado is a smaller operator, but is trying to expand their brand, it's more likely that they're going to try to link up with an existing operator in Massachusetts and produce their gummies that way.
Okay, so the actual marijuana can't cross state lines. It'll have to be sourced, produced in the other state. And so then, yeah, I can see why that would make a lot of sense for a smaller operator to, you know, find someone who's up and existing and say, hey, do you want to produce my brand of gummies?
Exactly. To throw a wrinkle into that a little bit, there have been states, California is one of them, who have proposed legislation to basically enter into agreements with neighboring states for interstate commerce. In other words, to be able to cross lines from California to Washington or to Oregon. But a lot of the proposed legislation that you see along those same lines, it's contingent upon federal legalization, which that's maybe getting into the weeds a little bit too much. But there has been some proposals that have been made to account for being able to cross state lines. But as it stands right now, if I'm a gummy producer in Colorado and I want to end up in Massachusetts, I need to either establish my own operations in that state or work with an existing operator.
Okay. And it's going to sound like I have dreams of being a gummy manufacturer, but sticking with our fictitious gummy manufacturer. All right. So I've decided to partner up with someone in Massachusetts. So I've got a whole bunch of info in Colorado. You know, I have size of molds, my recipe, so I assume that's intellectual property. Are there any problems with getting that over to Massachusetts? Any, anything weirder than in, if I was just a regular baker or paper maker getting my info over other to my other satellite. Is there more involved in cannabis?
Yeah, I mean, that's where someone like me comes in. And I don't know. I mean, I think any industry, regardless of whether it's cannabis or some other manufactured good, is going to face the concern that, you know, there's always an inherent risk that if I take that gummy recipe and I give it to someone in Massachusetts, a manufacturer in Massachusetts, are they going to run off with it? Are they going to maybe improve upon it as far as take my proprietary recipe, add a few things and then call it something new, that sort of thing? And that's where contracts come in. And obviously at a certain point, I make this point to clients all the time, you know, we can write whatever we want to write in a contract, but at a certain point, there's a human element to this. And it has to be a certain level of trust with the operator that you're working with in Massachusetts. And that trust is obtained by doing due diligence into that operator in Massachusetts and not just picking the first company that you find. So to go back to the contract end of it, there has to be clear language in the contract that this is my IP. And hopefully that contract is pretty specific about what IP you're talking about, and that you're not to take it, you're not to improve upon it, to make any proprietary method or recipe off of it, that sort of thing, in terms of making sure that contract really contemplates that I need to be protecting this recipe to make sure no one in Massachusetts as an operator is taking it and running off with it.
Okay, so we'll stick with Colorado for a second. I'm an established, stick with gummy manufacturer, and I have a really recognizable brand in Colorado, and I obviously want that brand to now move over to Massachusetts. So my brand, my trademark, are there more complications with getting my brand and trademark in another state, especially if I'm especially if it's cannabis related?
Yeah, and this goes back to the initial conversation we were having about the distinction between hemp and marijuana. Again, marijuana products are still legal at the federal level. They're still a Schedule I substance under the Controlled Substances Act, which is essentially the federal law of the land in the United States when it comes to drugs. So what's important to realize is there's a mechanism to get a trademark for my brand at the federal level to protect it in all states. But the problem is that the USPTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, is not going to grant protection to an illegal substance. Okay. So if I say, here's my flower jar with my brand on it, flower meaning marijuana flower, it's going to be rejected right away because it's an illegal product. And one of the main requirements of getting a trademark is for the applicant to show that their product is being sold lawfully in commerce. So if it's an illegal product, by definition, you can't do that. So what has developed, again, state by state by state, is state level trademarks. So if I'm a gummy manufacturer in Colorado, in our example, I should be looking into Colorado state law in any other state that I operate in to see if there's state level trademark protection. Now you kind of have a chicken and the egg scenario with the manufacturer in Massachusetts, because ultimately to be able to get a trademark even at the state level in Massachusetts, I have to be selling those gummies lawfully in commerce. And how you handle that as far as with the Massachusetts manufacturers, again, in that contract, you contemplate the fact that that trademark application is going to need to be filed once these gummies are actually sold in Massachusetts, in that the manufacturer is going to do nothing to interfere with that application or otherwise try to steal the intellectual property.
Wow. All these extra complications I would have never thought of. No, that's fascinating that, you know, we've got our own, like I said, in Canada, we've got our own set of hoops, but you guys seem to have us beat right now on if you want to be in multiple states. So I'll open this. Well, actually, before I just ask you any other interesting cases, let's circle back to hemp. So, you know, my starting source has the less than 0.3% THC, And I, well, because like everybody else, I process that into a CBD something. I process that into CBD tea. Does that make my life easier if I'm now dealing with hemp instead of marijuana?
So the thing to understand about hemp-derived products is that only certain types of products are allowed by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, at the federal level. And really what it boils down to is the FDA is really only allowing hemp-derived products to be added to cosmetics. So anything that really goes to affect the structure or function of the body is a no-no, and you're getting closer to it being a drug. So the first question to ask when you're looking at a hemp product is, what is the classification or type of product that you're dealing with? If you're dealing with anything that falls outside of what the FDA allows, which for the most part is really just cosmetics at this point, then you're looking at federal risk there. Where most people have gotten themselves into trouble, though, outside of just misclassifying or using a product that's not a legal classification at the federal level, is they're just making outlandish medical claims like this cures COVID or cures cancer, whatever the case may be. What's interesting, though, is that states have kind of taken a similar approach that they've taken with marijuana, in that marijuana, you know, as we've talked about, illegal at the federal level. But despite that, states have legalized it. What you're starting to see is the same thing develop with hemp. Hemp products are illegal at the federal level if they don't fall within those classifications. So, for example, the biggies outside of drugs is food and beverage. At the federal level, I can't add a CBD to a food or to a drink or whatever legally at the federal level. But a state like California recently at the state level is allowing it. So you're starting to see the same dynamic of the conflict between state and federal law in hemp, as we've seen with marijuana as well.
All right. So it's no simpler if I have a hemp derived company, unless I want to make a really, really good face cream. Then my hemp derived CBD face cream, you know, that should be simpler.
Yeah, but you know, ask me how many times when people call me about a hemp product that it's actually a cosmetic. It's usually, I would argue that it's really no more simple as, you know, compared to marijuana products. It's really, you end up with the same dynamic, and it's really a calculation of risk, whether it's a hemp or a marijuana operator. And I would also, just to go back to the gummy example, there's an entire area of law, and that is trade secret law, that really get into the protection of the gummy maker's proprietary blend and all of that. But that's probably getting a little too much into the weeds, but it's worth mentioning as well, outside of protecting the brand with state level trademarks and contracting things correctly.
Wow. So we're getting close to our end of our time. So I really better ask, because my imagination is only this big. Are there, obviously without releasing anything confidential, are there any sort of interesting cases you've run into lately that when it comes to cannabis or marijuana or hemp-based businesses that have come up, or things that come up often that you sort of wish people knew? Any sort of, top 10 lists of don't do this, or call me before you try that, that you think the audience might be interested in?
Well, I'll give you, to your latter questions of like, don't do this, is avoid marijuana or, cannabis puns at all costs.
Okay.
You see these horror stories constantly, and these aren't, it's nothing confidential, not my clients, but, people imitating other IP as well along the same lines, as far as like Nerds edibles, or Skittles edibles. It should go without saying, but you definitely want to avoid infringing upon anybody else's IP. And also, I think to that end, it's helpful to avoid using your stereotypical puns surrounding cannabis, because the odds that someone else has already used it are increased, in my opinion. But in terms of like litigation, and this is not really happened yet because we haven't seen federal movement yet, but I'll give you the hypothetical situation of, let's say gummy manufacturer that we've been talking about in Colorado has name X and they have a state level trademark in Colorado for name X. What happens when in Massachusetts, where our gummy manufacturer wants to work, there's an operator with that same name? You know, what's going to happen ultimately when federal law changes, interstate commerce is allowed and we have movement across state to states? What I think is going to happen is you're going to have producer, gummy bear producer in Colorado fighting with operator in Massachusetts over name X. I mean, that's the litigation from an IP perspective that I could see popping up that inevitably, and this coincides with don't use puns for names because you're increasing your chances this is going to happen, but I can see state to state there being a lot of fights in litigation about brand names and that sort of thing, because again, it's all siloed state to state to state, and that protection really only runs as far as the state boundary. So I could see litigation popping up, you know, between operators in different states who have the same or similarly sounding names. And it's, you know, you would have to talk to an intellectual property litigator to get a better idea of how that's going to play out. I am not a litigator in that space by any stretch, but I imagine a lot of it will come down to who was using the name first, who was able to get the registration first at the federal level, that sort of stuff.
Cool. Yeah, you're right. We really like our puns in the cannabis space. You're right. If I've thought of it, five people have thought of it before me, save myself the headache and go for something more boring and or more not punny.
Yeah. And I would also note, Trevor, this conversation, everything we've talked about could be completely different in Canada. I understand that the marketing restrictions, you would probably know more about it than I would. I don't know that you could do.
No, right now we can't do anything. Marketing is, yes. Note for Canadian listeners, none of this applies to you because right now you can basically do no marketing. Like there's been cases where, social media influencer said, you know, I really like, you know, brand X around Christmas, and the original manufacturer got in trouble because way back when they paid that social media influencer for something different. Like marketing is very, very restrictive here. And definitely consult a Canadian attorney on that one, because there are almost nothing you can do marketing wise in Canada. Hopefully around a lot of other things will be changing shortly, because, you know, really hard to build up your brand if you can't tell anybody about your brand.
Yeah, and we could do an entire other podcast on influencers in the United States as far as FTC regs and making sure that if I pay an influencer to advertise my product on Instagram, for example, I have to be very clear and make sure that influencer understands that they need to be disclosing the relationship that we have and that it's a paid relationship and the like. You saw Kim Kardashian and a lot of other celebrities are getting in trouble right now and will continue to I think they put ads out on Instagram for like crypto and they didn't disclose that they were paid to do that. And the idea is the average consumer could be confused or duped by that to think that, oh, Kim Kardashian is genuinely endorsing this product. She's, you know, whereas if they knew she was being paid to do it, would that change their opinion on the product? That sort of thing. And that you see a lot of collaborations in the United States with musicians and cannabis and whatnot. So it's kind of the same deal, but another topic for another.
Yeah, I was going to say that might have to be a follow-up one on for another day. So our time is running short. Is there anything you wished I'd add or anything I missed that you think the audience might not like to know about?
No, I mean, I would just make the point that I think any of the topics we've talked about, you could talk about for an hour. This is really high level stuff, but I appreciate you having me on. It was fun.
So Kirk, so let's see, intellectual property. So that's not just my gummy recipes. That might be my trademark, my packaging. And then how do you trademark something that isn't actually federally legal? Well, you really can't. So, you know, then do you trademark it in your state, and what's going to happen down the road if when it becomes federally legal? I can see why you need a lawyer to to walk you through all this.
Yeah. Yeah. Lawyers, I think lawyers have a sense of humor. Most of the lawyers I know have a sense of humor. Some of the best jokes are lawyer jokes, but you know, we've done this podcast now for 6 years. We've interviewed scientists, nurses, doctors, internists, lawyers, psychologists. And it always comes down to definition, right? How do you define cannabis? How do you define marijuana? How do you define blah, 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 X and O? Well, what does a lawyer do? He defines marijuana and hemp. So he takes cannabis and separates it into two different parts. And that's how he defines cannabis. Is it over 0.3 milligrams of THC? Then it's marijuana and it's illegal. So, I mean, I found that fascinating because, you know, as you listen to these stories, you try to pick up little nuances of the story, and lawyers speak differently than the rest of us, and they define cannabis this way. And but it's funny though. I mean, we've done hemp episodes, and all of them, I mean, we know the definition of hemp, right? Anything less than 0.3 milligrams of THC is legally hemp. So, yeah, lawyers.
Yeah, no, and like I said, the law stuff usually bores me to tears, but I really enjoyed this one. Just all the hoops and, you know, what you have to do it properly.
It gives
me a new appreciation for what you do if you were trying to own and run a company in the U.S.
It's an antidote that I heard. I was thinking about this. How long ago did I hear this? And I'm thinking it's about 15, maybe it's about 15 years ago. It was before I started going north. A friend of mine in Winnipeg has an international business, and he moved his business into China. And I said to him, that's interesting, going into China. Isn't China notorious for stealing intellectual property? And he said, you know, when we factor that into the equation, when we amortize the expenses, et cetera, et cetera, and he got into business speak, and, you know, this little nurse was trying to keep up with that. And he got into it, and he basically said, you know, we factored that into the equation, that, you know, over how many years it would take for them to duplicate our work. Even though they have a contract, they went into China knowing their work was going to be duplicated eventually, their factory secrets, and that was part of the equation. So I was sitting there with that antidote in my head, listening to this and about the States, and thinking, David Crosby, when we talked to him and he was trying to copyright or you know, get his Mighty Cross brand out there, he had to go to individual states and he had to do all this stuff, and it just seems very cumbersome and I guess hopeful. And I would imagine state law contracts are a little stronger than international contracts to China. But when you still have to consider that your intellectual knowledge might be taken by just crossing a border, that's pretty threatening. And it doesn't allow you as a businessman to stretch.
Yeah. No, it's back to, you know, contracts are good and fine and necessary, but if you're going to partner up with somebody in a different city, state, or country, it's a real good idea if you trust them first.
Yeah. Could have a lot of fun with trust. You know, I enjoyed this one. It was very much American-centric. So we'll have a link on him on our webpage. And basically the services he provides is he creates and implements cannabis compliant programs. He structures, drafts, and closes compliant deals. He permits, he helps with permitting and licensing. So he really can help you set up your business between states. We need to get a Canadian lawyer. And ironically, as I was Googling him, I found another bunch of Canadian lawyers in Toronto that specialize in cannabis. So I've reached out to see if there's any similarities in Canadian law with what you found with the American stuff.
Honestly, I think I would find that surprisingly interesting as well. But to wrap up this one, I'm Trevor Shufeldt. I'm the pharmacist.
I am Kirk Nyquist, the registered nurse, and we are Reefer Madness, the podcast. We are found on all those platforms. We have a very, very comprehensive webpage. Tell your friends about us. tell your students that are in medicine, anybody you know that's taken a health-related course, tell them about Reefer Madness, the podcast.
Growing every week.
Oh, we're budding. We're a budding podcast.
We're budding, yeah. have to end on a dad pun. All right, Kirk, it was another good one. We'll talk to you soon. Everybody out there, come back.
All right, man.
And there you go, another good one. It's Renee back here at the studio with a couple of things to wrap up the episode. One is that we always like to acknowledge that we produce our shows here in Dauphin on Treaty 2 territory in the homeland of the Métis. And we like to pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of the land and consequently reaffirm our relationships. The other thing is we usually end with a piece of music, which would be a request by the guest. We don't have a request as such, so I'm choosing the song, and we'll go out today with Lawyers in Love by Jackson Brown. Thanks, everybody.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermad.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Talk to you later.
I can't keep up with what's been going down. I think my heart must just be slow. Beautiful. They land at 6 o'clock and there we are, the dutiful. Eating from TV trays, tuned into happy days. Waiting for World War III while Jesus slaves to the mating calls of lawyers.
Yeah, that's always the struggle is real, especially when you know you're a podcast and the whole point is to record what you're talking about.